Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, you are very welcome to The Tonight Show. Will it break the bank to bring back the six counties? A new report claims a united Ireland could cost 20 billion euros a year for the next 20 years.
We can't be blind to where we are in the political process at this time. The institutions in Northern Ireland have only just been restored, and the constitutional question is one that can be considered, you know, over time.
Plus, are you Team Simon? Independent TDs take sides on whether to elect Simon Harris Taoiseach next Tuesday. And US President Joe Biden brands Gaza aid strikes unacceptable in what were called a frank call with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Well, according to a new research paper by the Institute of International and European Affairs, a united Ireland could cost the state 20 billion euro for 20 years. The report went on to detail how reunification could result in significant increases in taxation and increased social welfare spending and a reduction in public expenditure across the island. Well, joining me to discuss whether the taxpayer would be prepared to foot the bill is Fianna Fáil Senator and leader of Seanad Éireann, Lisa Chambers, Sinn Féin TD Patrick McLaughlin, adjunct professor at Trinity College Dublin and co-author of this report, John Fitzgerald. And joining the conversation down the line is former political special advisor Peter Card. Well, a reminder to you at home about our nightly live interactive poll, which allows you to have your say. Tonight we're asking, would you support paying more taxes to help fund a united Ireland? You can vote online on virginmediatelevision.ie/vote or follow the QR code on your screen, and we will bring you the poll results a little later in this segment. So to go to you first, John, that 20 billion figure, which has been pretty headline grabbing today, it is a mixture, I suppose, of the subvention that's been paid and the standardisation of other costs. Bring us through it briefly.
All right. Based on figures from 2019, there was a hole in the public finances in Northern Ireland of about 10 billion euros. Well, it was 11 billion, but you're knocking off the cost of the British Army, which is much bigger. It comes down to about 10 billion. So if we had to fill that hole, we'd have to find the 10 billion. On top of that, welfare payments and public sector pay rates are much higher in the Republic. And it would, if we have a united Ireland, I think you'd have to treat every citizen the same. So having to raise welfare and public sector pay rates in Northern Ireland would cost another 10 billion. That's where you get the 20 billion from.
As a country, some might argue, look, we could afford that. But you say, look, covering that cost would result in an immediate reduction in the standard of living for people living in the Republic.
Yeah, that cost would be about a third of the cost of the bank bailout. So it's like having a bank bailout every 3 years. So that's the kind of pressures that it would bring. Now, as you move forward, if Northern Ireland made major reforms, in particular an education system to raise productivity, and it grew more rampantly over the next 15, 20 years, the gap would narrow and the cost would come down very significantly.
There have been criticisms of your report today from the ESRI and from Professor John Doyle from DCU has written a report too. He said he put the figure at, I think, 3 billion, he said, with the initial figure. He said that the assumptions that you make about what we would have to concede in Ireland, what we would have to pay in Ireland, are pessimistic, really, in the extreme, and therefore not reasonable.
Well, he assumes the UK government will continued to pay the bulk of the money to Northern Ireland, even long after you have a united Ireland. I don't think the British would be that generous. And in particular, given that Scotland is considering independence, if they set the precedent of continuing to pay pensions and let Northern Ireland off the debt, they'd have to do the same for Scotland. And the bill for that would be massive. So that's why I don't think the UK government is that generous.
But do you also assume in your report that the Republic of Ireland would have to pay the entire pension bill for those in Northern Ireland, that we would have to continue financing some of the UK debt that's there, that we would have to immediately recalibrate all of those payments, social welfare payments, pensions that you talked about, public sector pay, and that the output in Northern Ireland remains exactly the same? Well, that is quite pessimistic, is it not?
Well, I think that to have unification and have people, our northern cousins, paid much less in social welfare than people south of the border, I think that that's, you could do it, but I don't think it would be fair or reasonable. Once you have a united Ireland, you have a united Ireland, and you should treat everybody equally. In terms of pensions, the way my pension is paid, everybody pays PRSI into the pension fund, and that is used to pay my pension. In a united Ireland, everybody in Northern Ireland would be paying PRSI, and the revenue commissioners would collect that in Dublin and use it in Ireland. To expect the UK government to then pay the pensions when Dublin is getting the revenue, I just don't see that happening.
There were some other things you didn't standardise. You didn't standardise the taxes, did you, between the two jurisdictions? Why not? Why did you not do that?
There are a lot of other economic changes which would take place, some good, some bad, as a result of unification. So we've only looked in a partial way at this. So you'd have to look at cutting Northern Ireland off from its market in Britain, which is fully integrated. That would be bad. It, fully integrating into on the island would be good. So there'd be other pluses and minuses you've got to look at. So we are just looking at the funding of Northern Ireland.
OK, Patrick McLaughlin, I heard you were speaking on the radio earlier today, and you very much contested some of the analysis that really underpins this report. On what basis?
Well, you referenced two professors. So you had Seamus McGuinness from the ASRI and Professor John Doyle from DCU. And to summarise, their very serious criticism of the report is, number one, in relation to the subvention. So John Doyle was on the radio earlier today and he talked about the peer-reviewed research that he carried out. He estimates it's not 9.4 billion sterling, but about 1.5 billion sterling. And he is, you know, looking at issues of pension. I mean, you have British citizens who are living around the world who, I mean, in Ireland, for example, who still get their pension. They paid their dues. The British government honour that commitment to pay their pensions.
But they wouldn't have renounced, I suppose, their position within the United Kingdom. That would be the difference.
Well, you know, I cannot see. I mean, you can say legally they don't have to do it, but morally, yes, they would have to honour that. And we're talking here about, you know, a referendum on both parts of the island where the Irish people on both parts would have voted yes for unification. You know, there will be a period of transition. There will be a situation where and the second component of the criticism is around the economy in the north. I mean, the reason why there's a subvention is because partition has had a devastating impact. I'm from Donegal, and I see it at first hand, the impact of partition. I believe that in the time ahead, but certainly in the context of reunification, there'll be a dramatic change to the economy in the north. So basing an analysis on the state of the economy now in the north and on a subvention that would be very, very different in the context of United Ireland is not a good approach.
So you say that subvention that we see now in Northern Ireland, that is driven by an underperforming economy, by low productivity in Northern Ireland, and if there was a united Ireland, that would change. But it wouldn't change in the short term, would it? That would take time. So in the short term, do you accept there would be a cost here?
Well, the first point that the two professors made today is that in the context of United Ireland, you wouldn't be inheriting a subvention of 9.4 billion. It would be realistically about 1.5 billion.
OK, but that, in fairness to those two professors, that figure has been disputed by John Fitzgerald and by the other author of this report.
But now you're getting to a very good point, actually, is that we have eminent, and I actually give credit to John and Edgar, and I do it again now, for taking the initiative and doing this. We have a government that has no plan for Irish unity. They're not steering this. There's no issue of a citizens' assembly. Like, we need to responsibly plan. We need to have debates. We need to have economic analysts, professors, people looking at health systems, education systems. There's a huge amount of preparation to be done.
OK, but do you accept that there is a cost, Pádraig McLoughlin, there would be a cost to Irish taxpayers in the immediate if there was to be a reunification of Ireland?
My strong view, if you look at, you know, there's been research like Kurt Hubner of the British University in Columbia there in Canada, who carried out extensive research that talked about, you know, being 34 billion benefit over 8 years. So there's lots of different views on this. My own strong view is that Irish reunification would be a benefit to the Irish economy across the island of Ireland. I think it would be a success. I think having one island of 7 million people with one health system, one education system, one economy can only work for all of us.
OK, would there be a cost, Lisa Chambers? So it's not clear from Pádraig McLoughlin whether he thinks there would actually be an immediate cost or not.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty obvious, of course, there would be a cost. But it's about making the case that that cost will be worth it and actually being able to answer questions that people will be asking in a referendum debate and coming up to a question about a united Ireland. I mean, I think it's disingenuous for reports that the government have no plan. Under this government, and it would be nice if Sinn Féin acknowledged this, the Shared Island Unit was set up by Taoiseach Micheál Martin in through his office, putting government money directly behind cross-border projects to unite people, not just unite the island. And that's really important.
I don't think, to be fair, Lisa Chambers, I mean, I canvassed opinion sort of across even the office today. Nobody could tell me what the Shared Island Initiative was about, and nobody could tell me what it has achieved in terms of actually putting down a set plan or addressing some of the issues that John has brought up in his report about the cost of United Ireland.
Well, what I will say on that is that no party has produced costings for uniting the island. It's a very difficult thing to cost. But under this government, there's been genuine initiatives and money put behind community projects, cross-border, as I said, to unite communities, which is what it's about. So I think having a pop at one another that you're not doing enough or you don't have a plan, I haven't seen Sinn Féin's plan for United Ireland either. I think this report provides, I think, interesting information, and somewhere in the middle is probably accurate. There are questions to be asked. If we look at the Brexit referendum, for example, never ask a question where you can't answer what it will look like if you vote to make a constitutional change of that nature. So we do need to ask questions around what happens to the police service on the island, what happens to our health service if we amalgamate those two,
okay, but
what happens to our social services, our
to the costs. Would Fianna Fáil say yes, we agree, we are willing to pay increased taxes in order to fund United Ireland?
I think what we need to do is be honest with people that you're not going to have a change of that magnitude uniting two jurisdictions, combining two jurisdictions without disruption and without some challenges. But it's about working that out and having a plan in place.
I'm just trying to figure out what does that look like, because John Fitzgerald has said clearly there would have to be cuts to public expenditure or there'd have to be increases in taxes. We're talking a third of a bailout a year.
Yeah, and look, that's an eye-watering amount of money, if we're being honest about it. But is that the actual cost? Nobody can really say. And we're basing that on today's picture. But I think Northern Ireland hasn't really had the opportunity to properly get going. Now it has a situation where the executive is back up and running. Northern Ireland has the opportunity, because of its access to both the Great Britain market and the EU market, it could be a fantastic hub for foreign direct investment. So it has the opportunity to increase its productivity. We're not going to unite the island tomorrow or next week. It's a longer term project.
Just so very briefly, John, why did you not factor in the potential for this increased productivity that we're going to see in Northern Ireland now that it does seem to have stability there and it is in this very, very fortunate position of having access to both the UK economy and the EU?
In a series of papers, we said Northern Ireland could make a big change in its productivity if it dramatically changes its educational system. The really big problem in Northern Ireland is its educational system. And the research which we've done, and it's Seamus McGuinness's research with Eimear Smith from DSRI really reinforces this. If you change the educational system, 20 years later, you will begin to see productivity effects. We reformed our educational system in 1967, and the 1990s we saw a boom. 20 years on, if Northern Ireland does it tomorrow, you'll see a boom in Northern Ireland.
Okay, so it's back
years.
To that point, isn't it, Pádraig? There'll be a lag. There could be a 20-year period while we are waiting for that productivity in Northern Ireland to be addressed, and there's going to be a cost. Well, and to the point, I suppose, that Lisa made, why has Sinn Féin not put together clear proposals about what a united Ireland would look like in a very practical sense?
Yeah, well, the first thing I want to say is that we're not talking about Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. Fianna Fáil are in government. You have the huge resources of government, the full effort of the state. to actually have a plan, to actually have an analysis, to have a debate.
But this is meant to be in your DNA, isn't it? This is the very foundation of Sinn Féin.
We were looking at Seamus McGuinness today. For example, Seamus McGuinness is an eminent professor, was asked the question today, and he said you'd need to combine the entire resources of the state. You'd need to have a look at the academic resources of the state to look at this. But that's a welcome debate, so we need to have that. But in terms of the North, we're in a phase now where, thanks to the Irish people standing the ground, confronting the Tories, no hard border on the island of Ireland, the people of the North have access to both the British economy and the European Union economy. So there's a real chance for growth in the time ahead. And, you know,
so perhaps the status quo for Northern Ireland is actually more beneficial?
Well, what I would say very clearly, if you look at the All-Ireland economy, one of the few benefits of Brexit is that the All-Ireland economy, North and South, has increased significantly. So there is actually progress in the North, but we need to see a lot more. I mean, there's no doubt, and the final point is this, the problem in the North is all the fiscal rules, taxation, everything is controlled by the British government. The sooner we have reunification, the better for everybody in this
island. Well, Horik, how can you sit there and accuse others of not having a plan? Sinn Féin has no plan. You've produced no plan. So you can't really sit there and throw stones at other parties. I mean, actually, if you get into that, that's just fact. And I think to say that there's a conversation and a debate to be had, if we get into that constitutional debate with the public, they will be asking us the questions. How will it work? What will it look like? What will it cost? You can't answer that question. I'm not saying I can answer it, but I could at least be honest about it. And that's the debate
With all due respect, you've supported Fine Gael. No, you're in government. You've supported Fine Gael for eight years.
That's not accurate either.
Well, actually, we supported the Kurt Hubner report, which you probably haven't read.
The point is...
No, 8 years in government.
Don't assume what I've read and haven't read.
8 years in government, and you haven't done nothing to advance this cause. 8 years.
Produce your own plan. Peter Cardwell. Peter, thank you for joining us. Peter, I would imagine a lot of unionists, those who might be very reluctant to join reunification in Ireland, to be part of that, read this report today with a sense of glee.
Yes, I think they're delighted with the fact that finally we have some realistic numbers. Padraig McLaughlin can talk his fantasy economics, of course, throughout the programme, but I'll probably go with a professor of economics at Trinity in terms of the person who actually knows what they're talking about. So certainly Professor Fitzgerald has put together something very interesting. I think if the Irish taxpayer wants to pay 55 million euro a day for reunification based on these figures, well, that's something that will take a lot of convincing. And I think there are lots of lazy arguments around this in regard to thinking that simply the Irish taxpayer and the Northern Irish taxpayer will simply go for a United Ireland at some stage, and there's an inevitable sort of slippery slope towards a United Ireland. That's not the case. I think there probably would be a unification yes vote in Ireland in the 26 counties. In the six counties, it's interesting because you have unionist nationalists, but you also have this other aspect. You have an increasing number of people who are deciding what they want based on economics. And the clear economic argument and analysis today shows that it would cost people in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland a huge amount of money. The fact is that Northern Ireland...
The argument would be from some, Peter, that it is not for people just a matter of economics. It is for many an ideology, and they are perhaps willing to pay the price for that.
Well, that's absolutely right, and that can't be argued with. An ideology, history, links, or culturally, a bit of romanticism and so on, in both the unionist and nationalist Republican arguments, are absolutely factors. There's no doubt about that. But when it gets down to brass tacks, and I'm glad that Professor Fitzgerald has put this together and that we're actually having this discussion, because as Padraig McLaughlin has shown, Sinn Féin has no practical plan for what a United Ireland would actually look like. And when you have those arguments, and when you talk about things like the fact that the NHS is so beloved in Northern Ireland, it's certainly not perfect with waiting lists 15% higher than the rest of the United Kingdom. It's not perfect, but it's something that people like. It's free at the point of use. The fact that there are higher salaries for many roles in the public service in the Republic. The fact that there are 23,000 civil servants in Northern Ireland, which is a huge number of people for a nation of about 1.8 million people. So there are all these questions to be asked.
Let me just bring, let Padraig McLaughlin come back in there and respond to what Peter's
saying. Gladly would do that. You know, you reference, you know, John Fitzgerald. You ignored Professor Seamus McGuinness, who's an eminent professor of economics in the ESRI. You ignored Professor John Doyle, who's an eminent professor, who would contest very strongly what John Fitzgerald and Morgan have said. So You also ignore the report from Kurt Hubner that Sinn Féin would have strongly supported. That would have showed an economic gain. So you choose the analysis you want to choose to defend your position. And the truth is, as a unionist, that partition has been a disaster for the north of Ireland. Belfast was a larger city than Dublin 100 years ago. Belfast was a larger city than Dublin. It was the economic heartland of the island of Ireland. Okay. Partition has devastated the north, and unionists need to understand
nonsense.
That and accept that.
Absolute nonsense.
Well, Peter, do you want to respond to that, that there has been a cost to partition, and this report points out that there is an underperforming economy and there are poor educational outcomes for the majority of young people in Northern Ireland?
And there's no doubt about that, and I'm delighted that our neighbours in the Republic of Ireland have a strong economy. I think there are many problems within that. Homelessness, immigration, housing in general, people getting on the housing ladder are problems within that. It's not a perfect state either, although I'm delighted to see it thrive in many ways. Northern Ireland is a place that for the moment and probably in the future does need some subsidy from the British taxpayer. There is certainly 15% more money spent on people in Northern Ireland than England, Scotland and Wales. But if there is Irish unification, the Irish taxpayer in the 26 counties is going to find a rude awakening here, a huge amount of money, a standard of living drop. And those economic arguments are very important to have because they are tangible and they are not as straightforward as the sort of stuff that Sinn Féin often rely upon, the romanticism, the history, those kind of links. So it's very important to have this discussion. Let's bring in all the economists and talk about it. But I'm very happy with Professor John Fitzgerald's paper.
Well,
and I think it's very interesting.
Does Peter believe that partition of Ireland has been good for the north of Ireland, that the north of Ireland economy,
yes.
You think the private sector has been performing well in the north of Ireland under partition?
I didn't say that.
Okay. So you think it's going well? You think the economy has gone well up there relative to the rest of Ireland?
Surely you, like everyone in Sinn Féin, is a socialist. So presumably you don't want the private sector to thrive. I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens.
What a nonsense statement.
I mean, is Sinn Féin not a socialist party?
What a nonsense statement about not wanting people to have jobs and business to thrive.
I'm just going to go back
nonsense.
To my guests here. One of the calls here has been for a citizens' assembly, John Fitzgerald, to tease these issues out a bit further. Do you think that's necessary? Is that the answer? Is that just throwing responsibility to somebody else?
I don't see what a citizens' assembly would bring to this. Citizens' assembly worked well on an issue like abortion, where it convinced politicians that they could sell this to the people of Ireland on United Ireland, where you're dealing with all sorts of a whole range of technical issues. That's not for a citizens' assembly. That's for the political system to deal with.
Lisa, that's for the government, and the government, bar this Shared Ireland initiative, hasn't done very much to try and further the conversation about what a united Ireland looks like and what it would cost.
Well, sorry, the Shared Ireland initiative isn't a small initiative. It's a very significant initiative put in the Taoiseach's office. So just to make that point, I would agree with John. I don't think a citizens' assembly is appropriate for a conversation of this magnitude around constitutional change and a change of that nature on the island. A citizens' assembly, 100 people, I think we need to include more than that on a conversation like this. And we have to have a conversation, warts and all. There are difficulties and challenges, and anybody presenting a picture that this
but
is
when?
Somehow...
when are we going to have the conversation?
If I can finish my point, we're having it now.
No, but when? Anybody, when in real terms?
Anybody making the point that this is going to be easy or plain sailing...
Yeah,
or,
but that's a fair point.
Fair point,
when? When? We're saying we need to have a conversation. You're saying we're having it now. But actually, when will there be a plan? Because this is one of Fianna Fáil's objectives too, isn't it?
Of course, we're a Republican Party. We want to see the island united. I think every person shares that ambition for our country. Of course we do. But it's about having an honest conversation. When I hear Sinn Féin saying, oh, the government have all these resources, you're the best funded party on the state. I'm sure you can search around in the coffers and put enough money together to put a plan in place.
Talk about deflection. Deflection.
Sorry,
4 years.
You made the point that we had no plan.
Confidence is applied for 4 years. Confidence is applied for 4 years. In government for 4 years. 8 years. That they've had the ability to drive this forward. Fianna Fáil are clearly not serious, unfortunately.
Take a look at our nightly interactive poll. We've been asking you, would you support paying more taxes to help fund a united Ireland? The result of that poll is 35% of people say yes and 63% of people say no. Are you surprised by that?
No, when you see a headline figure that you have 20 billion per year, it'll lead us to rack and ruin. You know, if you ask me a question.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
In the context of a report like that, of course that's going to be their answer. But when you have a proper debate with economists looking at this in proper detail, with a proper debate amongst experts, then I think you'll have a different outcome.
Sorry, Pádraig, at our own peril, ignore the response to that. We have to have an open and honest conversation and lay it all out.
OK, let's just go back to Peter. I'm just wondering, I suppose, given what we are seeing in Northern Ireland, given what we've seen in the DUP in recent weeks, given the fact that we now have a First Minister who's from Sinn Féin, are unionists more concerned, more worried about the prospect of reunification than ever?
Yes, I think they are. And certainly post-Brexit, we have been talking about the border an awful lot. I think of the golden era of British-Irish relations, really going back to the Queen's visit and President Higgins' state visit to the United Kingdom as well. Those visits were incredibly important. And post-Brexit, it really has been, the border is something we've talked about a lot. I'm not scared of the conversation. As a unionist, I'm happy to have it. I'm happy to have a practical discussion about it based on facts. But certainly unionism and what has happened in the last few days is in crisis for many, in many respects, politically as well. I think Stormont is fine. I think it'll be stable for some time to come, but it will, certainly for the DUP, they have a lot to do to get back the initiative here. And there's a lot of division within unionism, certainly in regards to that decision to go back into Stormont. So we'll see what happens there. But certainly Sinn Féin have the whip hand in this regard, both in Northern Ireland and I think as your own election becomes forward in the Republic as well, it'll be fascinating to see what happens. And you could very soon have a Sinn Féin First Minister and indeed a Sinn Féin Taoiseach.
OK, very briefly, John, your father wrote about his hopes of seeing a reunited Ireland. They obviously weren't realised in his lifetime. Will they be realised anytime soon, do you think?
Probably not in my lifetime.
All right, we'll leave it there. My thanks to John Fitzgerald and to Peter Cardwell. Up next, who's with who? Independent TDs decide whether to support Simon Harris's bid to become the Taoiseach, but at what cost? Do you stay with us? Well, as of tonight, four independent TDs have pledged their support to Minister for Higher Education Simon Harris to become Taoiseach when the Dáil returns on Tuesday, the 9th of April. Meanwhile, Kildare Street is aflutter with speculation as to whether gender, geography and good behaviour could influence the makeup of Simon Harris's cabinet. Well, Fianna Fáil Senator Lisa Chambers, Sinn Féin's TD Pádraig McLoughlin and Assistant News Editor with the Business Post Sarah McGuinness have joined me to discuss this to you. First, Sarah, who has pledged support? Who has Simon Harris managed to woo?
Woo? Well, I don't really know. It's kind of quite divided at the minute. So really, those who are kind of most ambitious within Fine Gael have correctly and strategically decided to row in behind Simon Harris. Neil Richmond was one of the first off the block. And of course, he is in the Department of Enterprise, which now has a very significant vacancy. There's also Peter Burke, who is Minister of State for European Affairs. He is kind of being tipped for perhaps the justice portfolio. He's kind of proved himself as someone who's a pretty steady pair of hands. Patrick O'Donovan, the Limerick TD, who also could be in line for a promotion. But then, of course, you know, up in the higher ranks, there's been, at first there was a little bit of resistance. You know, it took a while for the likes of Pascal Donoghue. At first he said that he wasn't going to run, but then didn't immediately endorse Harris, unlike Heather Humphreys, who now is likely to be deputy leader of Fine Gael. And then there's of course this kind of question about Helen McEntee's future. previously herself, Simon Coveney, Leo Varadkar, it's kind of understood that they had quite a good working relationship. Simon Coveney is obviously gone. Leo Varadkar is obviously gone. And Helen McEntee was once a rival to Simon Harris, really, for the throne. That's obviously changed now. But there's kind of questions about will he back her in her justice portfolio, or will she be moved elsewhere?
And in terms of the independents, I suppose, that have pledged support, some of them have come out publicly to do that.
Sorry, yes. So this was kind of something that was people have been watching closely over the last week. This really would be a bit, this was seen as kind of a bit of a hurdle for Simon Harris this time last week, in the sense that, you know, independent TDs, they could have decided Labour want a general election, Sinn Féin want a general election, maybe I want a general election. So far in the last couple of days, he's been in talks. He says that it's not, they weren't transactional discussions, but
nobody believes that. It's always been transactional. That's the way Irish politics has worked.
Oh, completely. So in the last about 48 hours, five have come out distinctly saying that they support Simon Harris. So they are Noel Grealish of Galway, Dennis Naughton of Sligo Leitrim, Mark McSherry, Michael Lowry, Joe McHugh, Nessa Horgan is also has also said that she would be voting for Simon Harris.
And who's reserving judgment? Because he has had meetings with others, hasn't he?
He has. So Sean Canney hasn't yet made up his mind as to whether he will vote in favour of the government. And Cathal Berry also hasn't. Now, Cathal Berry, it was kind of, in political circles, it's kind of understood that he probably will. He voted for Micheál Martin back in 2020. He voted for Leo Varadkar back in 2022. And he said today that he has some, like, they had quite constructive talks about topics, I suppose, close to his interest.
So he's still transacting, even though there's no transactions.
Yeah, he said he's going back to talk to his team and that they'll review. But, you know, like, if he's getting a good deal from Simon Harris, he obviously will vote for him.
OK, so why is, I suppose people will be wondering at home, the government has a majority. Why is this important? Why does he need to ensure he has the support of more independents?
Well, the government only has a wafer-thin majority of 81. There's 160 TDs in the Dáil. Helen McEntee, only her vote of no confidence was rejected by 83. So, you know, you're really kind of like, it's not that close. And then I suppose there's very vocal opposition then against Simon Harris, the likes of Matthew McGrath, the likes of the Healy Rays. You know, now there's obviously a divide in the Rural Independent camp, in the Independent camp, should I say. So, you know, whether the likes of, say, Mark McSherry could be swayed into the Matty McGrath camp, you know, there was really no saying.
And do we know what the price is for their support? I mean, when he would have had meetings with all of those independents, would he simply have been reaffirming some of the pledges or promises that Leo Varadkar would have had to make to them to get their support 3 years ago?
Yeah, I'd imagine it might have changed now because there's a lot more at stake. And really, you don't want to be coming into the top office with like a wafer-thin majority. You want to be coming into people who are going to be receptive to you. I imagine now, you know, there's been quite a shift in terms of law and order in the country. You know, rural areas are facing more issues than, say, like Dublin might, the likes of Cork might. So, you know, those kind of rural TDs would definitely probably be looking for something local and close to their hearts.
Are you concerned, Lisa, about that wafer-thin majority?
No, I think Tuesday will come. I think Simon Harris will be elected Taoiseach. And I think once the ministerial team is appointed between seniors and juniors, I think things will settle. And I don't get the feeling from talking to colleagues or even people on the opposition benches that there's any great desire for an election. I'm sure Pádraig will disagree with me. But
there is a cost, isn't there? I mean, what is that cost for independent support? And is it something that you're comfortable with?
I have no difficulty with transactional politics, as has been referred to. If you're an independent TD and the Taoiseach nominee is looking for you to support, of course you're going to advocate for your county and say, I'd like a project delivered. Why wouldn't you ask for it? It doesn't mean you're going to get it. But that's part of the negotiations. I don't have an issue with that. That's just a fact. Mm-hmm. Anyone saying that that is not part of politics, or that if a new government came in and that Sinn Féin would do things differently, is just selling people a pup, in my view. That's the way politics does work, in that people advocate for their areas and the people that they represent.
But I suppose maybe some people might be uncomfortable because the idea is that your constituency gets prioritised for your support over perhaps another project that is actually necessary.
No, because that's one opportunity to advocate for the place that you represent. But like every day of the week, as a public representative, you're pushing for your community, your area, you're advocating for those that elected you. So that's representational politics. It's the democracy that we have. So I have no issue with that whatsoever.
OK, but Michael Lowry, I suppose, has said, look, he wants assurances over Limerick Hospital. We've had Cathal Berry saying he has concerns over national security. I mean, what does Simon Harris prioritise to secure these votes?
That's a matter for Simon Harris. And I suppose from my perspective and from Fianna Fáil's perspective, I think we've been a very stable element of this government. And I think, you know, when Leo Varadkar resigned, Micheál Martin was straight out to the podium to reassure people that government will continue its work, that there's a programme for government to implement that's been agreed by the three parties, not just Fine Gael. So there's a programme of government there to be implemented. There's still 11 months left in this government. My view is that it should continue, it should finish its work, it should go the full term and deliver for people on health, on
housing,
education.
And you're not concerned about Fine Gael taking the credit for everything that's done? Look, because you were very clear there, this is a programme for government of three parties.
And it is, and it's three parties and not three individuals. So look, it's a matter for Simon Harris who he appoints as his team. The Fianna Fáil team is there, the Green Party team is there, and I think the public are, you know, are very well versed in Irish politics. We have a very educated and informed electorate. They will take it for what it is, but I think they're very much more interested in the government ministers getting down to business, doing their work and delivering for people.
I wonder, Brian McLaughlin, I mean, there was a sense here a couple of months ago that this election could be called in June, or perhaps we could have an election around the budget. And now it seems to be further away than ever. Is that a big disappointment to Sinn Féin?
Well, it's clear that the three government parties want to hang on as long as possible. I mean, if you take Fine Gael, they just look tired and worn out. I mean, you have Leo Varadkar out of the blue, 13 years in cabinet, walking away. Simon Coveney walking away. One third of their TDs are not going to run for election again.
And possibly more.
And possibly more walking away. So, I mean, the only price that Fianna Fáil and the Green Party have asked for to vote for Simon Harris is to stay the full term, to go the full term, hang on as long as possible. And I think people at home are looking at particularly housing. Sorry, I didn't interrupt you, Lisa.
We have
in
a
fairness,
mandate.
I didn't interrupt you now.
You did
in
last
fairness.
Time, actually.
Not in your last 3 or 4 minutes. We were interrupted once. So let me just speak and deal with the issues. Fianna Fáil were extremely critical of Simon Harris when he was Minister for Health. They actually brought down the last government over it. It's scoliosis, children's hospital, cervical check. You can check the record. The amount of Fianna Fáil TDs who were scathing in their criticism of him, now they're going to make him Taoiseach. You know, so like this government are hanging on the big issues of housing, health, cost of living.
But to the point, I suppose, that Lisa
them.
Made, there is no huge appetite, it seems, among politicians in government, and there's no huge appetite in the public. You know, that latest poll showed actually the majority of people do want to see this government go to the full term.
No, I think if you look at the recent poll, there's increasing numbers of people actually want a general election because they do not believe, particularly Fine Gael.
But the majority want them to go the full term. I know there isn't the increasing number of those looking for a general election, but the majority still
want. Yeah, but if you look at Fine Gael, they're 13 years in power. They clearly don't want to be in power. They're out of ideas. If you look at the areas, and I say it again, the disaster in housing, disaster in health services, cost of living, you know, to hang on for another year is just wrong.
Okay.
In 4 years now, it's time for an election.
And
the term is 5 years. But Sarah, just to go, I suppose, finally to the promotions, I don't know if people at home are as interested in these as we all are, but to what extent will geography and gender, and we said good behaviour, sort of play into Simon Harris's decisions to who's going to be promoted into those big ministerial positions?
I think it will really play a role because if you look at it, Simon Harris, he really has a year here, and then Fine Gael are looking at a very distinct possibility of going into opposition. So really, his first year as Taoiseach could very well be his last year for a while. So he's really going to want to put his own stamp on it. So if we look at who's there, I think putting Heather Humphreys as his deputy leader was kind of a big win in kind of, you know, she's very popular among rural Fine Gaelers. So that's kind of a win. So he kind of has a bit more wiggle room there. There's the likes of Jennifer Carroll McNeill, who's always been very ambitious as a junior minister, was tipped as potential leader for Fine Gael. She would be an obvious choice for either enterprise or justice because she works as a barrister and a solicitor. She's also a young woman. And for the TikTok Taoiseach, as he's become known as now, that would be, you know, pretty clever to put her in there. Then there's the likes of, as I said, Patrick O'Donovan, who's proved quite competent. He's a Limerick TD. You know, like he has been pretty good and across his brief. He's been in cabinet since 2016. You know, he would be another rural voice that would definitely be worth platforming. Then there's the likes of as well, you know, there's demotions aren't out of the question either. There's the likes of Hildegard Naughton, who's kind of, I suppose, left a lot to be desired in her performance so far. That would be a blow to Galway East, but there's always people waiting in the wings, like I mentioned, Alan Dillon. So, you know, it really is all to play for. And I suppose it might not feel that seismic right now. But if you look at the raft of resignations that have come from Fine Gael, these people could be the people trying to lead Fine Gael back into government 5 years down the line. So it is important if they're promoted now.
All right, look, we're going to have to leave that conversation there for now. My thanks to Lisa Chambers, to Padraig McLaughlin and to Sarah McGuinness. Up next, we speak with a consultant surgeon working in an emergency room in one of Gaza's busiest hospitals ahead of his return. Stay with us. You're very welcome back. Well, in their first phone conversation since IDF strikes killed seven World Central Kitchen aid workers, US President Joe Biden has warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza or face consequences. US National Security Council spokesman John Kirby had this to say at a White House press conference earlier.
The president made it clear that our policies with respect to Gaza will be dependent upon our assessment of how well the Israelis make changes and implement changes to make the situation in Gaza better for the Palestinian people.
Well, I'm joined now by US correspondent Nick Harper for more on this. Nick, there was also a statement from the Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, saying today that if Israel doesn't change course, then American policy will change. So there certainly seems to be a hardening of the US position, but what could that ultimately mean?
Well, it seems unclear at this stage, and indeed John Kirby wouldn't be drawn in the White House press briefing as to exactly what that change could be. But he did point out that he wanted to see real changes, and if there were no changes on the Israeli side, there would be changes on the US side. Now, he's certainly not saying, or the president is not saying, that if there are no changes, the US will stop all military assistance to Israel. They're not saying that the $18 billion deal that's in the works to sell F-15 fighter jets to Israel would be cancelled. But there is that very strong suggestion that the US is trying to use its leverage with that military aid on one side and with civilians and humanitarians' lives on the other to try and force some real change in terms of how the Israeli military is dealing with the situation in Gaza.
How do they describe the conversation that took place between Joe Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu this afternoon?
Well, we're told that it was about a 30-minute conversation, perhaps slightly less, which is not a dramatically long conversation. John Kirby, when asked to classify it, said that it was direct, businesslike, very professional from both sides. But he did state time and time again that the president had used this opportunity to say over the phone call with Benjamin Netanyahu in this one-on-one conversation that he was expressing the anger and the outrage that he has expressed publicly over the last few days in words and in statements, taking that directly to the Israeli prime minister to make it very clear that the situation is, in his words, unacceptable in Gaza and that some very real changes now need to take place.
So how significant then is this threat to change US policy when it comes to Israel?
Well, I think it could potentially be a turning point. We've certainly seen a hardening of language over the last few weeks, certainly within the last few days. There has been this growing rift that seems to be developing between the president here and the prime minister in Israel. But I think it is also worth pointing out that Joe Biden has been facing criticism over recent weeks about the contradictory nature of US policy. On the one hand, the US is saying that Israel needs to change its ways, but on the other hand is also saying that Israel has ironclad support from the United States and that the US will continue to fund it and its military campaign in Gaza. So really saying one thing, but also saying another. And he's come in for criticism, with some within his own party suggesting that it could lose him the election in November. Progressive Democrats who voted for him in the past, Arab Americans who voted for him in the past, have been saying increasingly that they do not intend to vote for him again because of what's taken place in Gaza and the fact that he has throughout given that very strong support to Israel without being able to force any changes. This, though, could perhaps be the moment when we see a shift in what's taking place there in Gaza.
Very briefly, Nick, the pressure also continues to mount on the UK government to suspend its arms supply to Israel, just very briefly.
Absolutely. Yeah, we've seen Prime Minister Rishi Sunak and David Cameron, the Foreign Secretary, there in the middle between two factions that have been calling either for change to UK policy or for it to remain the same. There's about £42 million that the UK gives every year. That could go away. But of course, if the UK changes its mind, maybe the US as well, will as well. We could see perhaps that domino effect, Kara.
All right, thank you, Nick. Well, Nick Maynard is a consultant surgeon who worked in Gaza with British charity Medical Aid for Palestinians. And since the outbreak of the conflict, he's witnessed harrowing conditions during his time at one of the only functional hospitals in the Strip. And Nick joins me down the line now. Nick, UNICEF tells us that children and adults are suffering malnutrition, but we're also hearing from Israel that this is sort of a false, you know, narrative that people are on the brink of starvation. What did you see?
Well, it's complete nonsense for the Israelis to deny what is happening. There's been an independent assessment of the state of the malnutrition in Gaza. The north of Gaza is in imminent danger of famine, which means that the extent of the malnutrition is extremely severe. This is not a condition now that can be dealt with just by giving food. These people are in an acute medical condition which needs inpatient care. And of course, that cannot be given. I saw malnutrition when I was working in Gaza a few weeks ago. I left there on the 9th of January. And when we came out, we spoke very loudly to various media outlets about what we saw was imminent malnutrition setting in. At Al-Aqsa Hospital, the paediatricians saw two cases of kwashiorkor, the most severe form of protein malnutrition, every week. We saw it in a lot of our surgical patients. So it is no surprise to me at all that northern Gaza has now been designated a famine condition. And I've spoken to people living in northern Gaza who are living on birdseed. They were eating animal feed. They've ran out of that. They're now eating birdseed. So the malnutrition now is extremely serious and will lead to many more thousands of deaths.
In terms of the impact of that attack on World Central Kitchen, we're hearing that there's been further disruption of aid into the Gaza Strip and there was so little getting in. In terms of medical aid, what was available to you when you were trying to carry out surgeries and what was that like, Nick?
It was pretty awful. I mean, it was very variable. There were some days when we had very little, very few drugs. There were days we had no morphine to give patients, no strong pain relief, no antibiotics some days. There were days we had no running water in the operating theatre, so we couldn't scrub up. There were days when we had no sterile drapes to cover the patients within the operating theatre. So it was variable, and it was made even more frustrating in many ways with the knowledge that these resources almost certainly were present in Gaza somewhere, but were in depots or stores. And it's the distribution of aid which is so impossible in Gaza because of the ongoing military activity. And we hear a lot about how to get aid to Gaza, and of course that's very important, and a significant amount is getting to Gaza, but it cannot be distributed. And therefore, vital resources which are needed to save lives are being denied to many of the patients there.
But Nick, you are returning to Gaza, are you not, in 2 or 3 weeks? What are you expecting to see?
I'm expecting to see. I've spoken to people on the ground today, in fact. So we're expecting to see very similar amounts of trauma, very similar amounts of bomb victims. But I think it's going to be far worse in terms of the malnutrition and the illnesses, the non-traumatic illnesses, the communicable diseases, the infectious diseases. We know there are many tens of thousands of patients with hepatitis A, many acute respiratory tract infections, and of course all the other non-communicable diseases.
Sorry, we've just run out of time there. I'm sorry to cut across you. I hope we can return to speak to you next week. Many thanks for speaking to us on the Tonight Show. We're going to have to leave it there from the Late Team here. Good night.